Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order this morning. We will hear the budget request of the Board of Public Defense, and we have two bills that I would like us to, to hear today. So, Kevin Kyer, is there anyone else that you have to present, or is it just you?
Just me, Mr. Chairman.
All righty. It's all yours.
Well, thank you. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. Excuse me. Thank you again for the opportunity to come in and visit a little bit about the Board's budget. As you can see, and I think all of you have in your packet, a handout for the Board's budget request, and I'm going to go through briefly just a quick overview, because I know we had the overview last month, but this is there's a few slides just as a quick overview. Mr. Chairman and members, as you all know, the Board of Public Defense provides district public defender services in the 10 judicial districts in the state of Minnesota, as well as the appellate office. And if we can get this slide presentation to work, we will continue. Oh, there we go. About 175,000 cases a year in felonies, gross misdemeanors, misdemeanors, and juvenile delinquencies. On the gross misdemeanors, the other category that you see there, by far the largest group of those, is probation violations. And that's a very rapidly growing part of the job that our folks are doing. District public defenders also provide statutorily mandated services to children over 10 in child protection cases, as well as non-mandated services to custodial parents in child protection cases. As you can see, Mr. Chairman, the next slide is number 5 is the breakdown of the cases by case type for public defenders. The appellate office provides criminal appeals, post-conviction proceedings, supervised release proceedings, and the sex offender community notification hearings. It also provides the appeals in those end of confinement review hearings as well. Again, that's one of us, as most of you are, I'm sure, aware, that's one of our more rapidly growing areas as well. The board's the largest user of the court system. As I said, 175,000 cases a year. Provide service in every county and in every courtroom in every county, which, as we talked about earlier, provides some logistical problems for us, especially in the rural areas. It does not control its caseload. We do not control how many cases we get. Once cases are assigned, they cannot be refused. All of those are controlled by outside factors, some of what you do here, obviously, some of what the court does, some of what the corrections folks do. Just all depends on what folks in various policy-making areas do. The other one is we do not control time commitments. We don't control how long it takes to do the hearings. We don't control, for example, the scheduling of cases. So we might, oftentimes in rural Minnesota, we might have a public defender who comes to court part-time in the morning, has one or two cases, and then waits the rest of the morning for another case to be called. The court's been very helpful to try to consolidate those in a number of places, but there are a number of places in greater Minnesota in particular where that's not the case yet. Again, and we really think of public defenders as kind of the quality control of the judicial system. If you think about, and we've had a number of police chiefs and sheriffs and prosecutors tell us that where we have properly funded public defenders, where we have public defenders who are doing their job and doing it well, it makes them do their job better, and it makes the system operate better. And if you think of the resources that the state has in terms of bringing to bear on an individual, that makes a certain amount of sense. I know a number of you were down at Ramsey, some of you were down at Ramsey County last month and saw, I think we counted 12 different folks, including public defenders, who are in that courtroom who have to make that process work. And it's all dependent, obviously, on the public defenders being there, being prepared, and being prepared well. And so it's quite an undertaking. Chairman, as far as the budget goes, the annual budget's $61.8 million. As you can see on slide number 8, about 90% of that is in district public defense. Of that amount, about 92% is tied up in personnel. About 5% of it is contractually obligated. We talk about contractual obligations being things like rent, things like we have in our personnel contracts with our employees, things like mileage and all those things. So you see there's not a lot of wiggle room for public defenders or for the district public defender budgets. The budget requests, there are three of them, and they're broken down into really kind of three areas. The first is public defender viability, or the trial level viability. The appellate caseloads, and also the Supreme Court Task Force, or the Children's Justice Initiative. And we'll talk about a little bit of those individually. Under the public defender viability piece, the first item is the projected shortfall. And when we talk about a shortfall for 2008 and 2009, we're talking about a couple of things. One is the filling of vacant positions. As we told you last year, or 2 years ago, we were going to continue to fill positions. We're going to continue to do that so we could make sure that the courts continue to operate, that we don't have those situations where, you know, we have somebody who leaves and we can't afford to fill behind them, and then there's a courtroom that goes unstaffed. So we've been trying to do that as much as we can and get those positions filled immediately. Past personnel cost pieces, I don't think this is any different than any of the other agencies that you see or some of the other committees are going to see, that the costs have outgrown the ability to pay for those in a number of cases. The Department of Finance projects an increase next year of, I believe it's 3.5% or maybe 3.25% over the next biennium in terms of personnel cost increases. And so that's included in that amount. Again, in order to keep those folks on staff or staffed and keep those positions maintained. Mandated pension cost increases. And when we talk about other cost increases, things like mileage, the IRS rate for mileage, things like that that have increased, and I know a lot of you have been dealing with in some of your other positions as well. The second piece of that is, public defender viability project is the serious caseload increases. As you can see by this chart, our felony cases in the last 2 years are up 16%, gross misdemeanors are up 11%. The probation violations are up 11%, and our child protection cases are up 10%. As we've gone around and talked to most of you over the last 30 or 45 days, this is a statewide phenomenon. It's just not a Minneapolis and St. Paul or a Hennepin and Ramsey County situation. Some of our biggest increases have been in places like the Duluth area, Mankato area, Bemidji area. We're not quite sure what's going on there, to tell you the truth. I know that our defenders will tell you that meth has a lot to do with it, and that continues to be a major problem out there. But there are other things as well. One of them is demographics. Obviously, we have a pretty big group of folks in that 13 to 24 age range, which also is always a big piece of this. So the request that we have for 34 new lawyers across the state would only go to address the caseload increases that we've seen over the last two fiscal years, between 2004 and 2006. If you look at the next slide, what you see is on that chart is we break our cases down into case units based on the seriousness, and this is one of the things we talked with you about back in January. Right now, the average across the state, the public defender is handling about 744 case units, the case unit being roughly the equivalent of a misdemeanor. When we hire people, when they come in and the public defender is doing their work, in a number of places outside of Hennepin and Ramsey County, they agree to take, particularly part-timers, they agree to take whatever cases come down the pipe. So, and they handle a variety of cases. So they may handle misdemeanor cases, they may handle felonies, they may handle child protection cases. They do a lot of different things. If they happen to be on the calendar that day when the big crim sex case comes down, or they happen to be on the calendar that day when the murder case comes down, that's their case. And it may take them several weeks from their practice in order to resolve that case, especially if it goes to trial. That's the gamble that those folks take. 744 case units, again, almost not quite double the caseload standards that the Bar Association and the board have set. Again, as I mentioned earlier, once assigned, those cases cannot be refused, and so that puts an additional burden on those public defenders because there's really no place for those cases to go. What it's meant is, over the last several years, our part-time defenders have put in a number of more hours than they're actually paid for. Last fiscal year, they put in about 40,000 excess hours. And that's been pretty consistent over the last several years. I think the prior year or 2 years before that was about 36,000 or 35,000. You can imagine what that does to not only the private practice, but also their family life. And what we have seen in a number of places is that defenders are starting to leave our service because they just can't keep up with the demands of both a private practice and a public defender practice. I was down visiting a couple of our defenders, in fact, 2 weeks ago. We have a young woman down in the first district, 35 years old, 40 years old, outstanding lawyer, has been with us for a number of years. We've gone through and she's done a number of our training sessions, handles everything and has handled everything from day one, from misdemeanors to felonies to child protection cases. Finally threw in the towel last week or 2 weeks ago. And she told me that the reason was that she couldn't devote the kind of time that, number one, her public defender clients deserve, but also her private clients. She was coming in on weekends. She was coming in evenings. The weekends were when her young kids were taking a nap, and she said she just can't do it anymore with a family. That's what we're starting to run into. We're running into quite a bit. Over the next few years, and it's not an issue that we're dealing with this legislative session, although just indirectly we are, we have about 25%, maybe even a little higher, of our lawyers who are age 50, 53 and above, that baby boomer group. Number of them part-time defenders. And the trick for us, or the key, is going to be how are we going to replace those part-time defenders in greater Minnesota? Because it's not real enticing for somebody fresh out of law school to come out and hang a shingle out in rural Minnesota and say, gee, we're going to give you a half-time salary or a three-quarter-time salary, and we're going to expect that you're going to put in 150 or 200 extra hours a year to do public defender work. So we've got a small group of us working on that right now just to come up with some options and look at what we might be able to do. We'd like to keep a part-time system. We think it's very efficient. It's good for clients. It's good for us. It's certainly good for you folks in terms of the value you get. But I'm just not sure we're going to be able to maintain that over the next several years, given what we've seen. I know we've talked to the County Attorneys Association, and they're experiencing some of the same issues in terms of recruiting and retaining county attorneys. I think the difference is we have a number more who are part-time, but also that, again, we can't refuse cases. So in that instance, we don't have that to offer to some of those folks that are coming out there.
Mr. Farrelly, I have a question, but I want you to finish your presentation first. How long do you think you need to finish up?
Mr. Chairman, I was told I have 25 minutes by your staff, so I'm going to do the best I can to get through that. So,
thank you. Okay.
Chairman, one of the other things that's happened over the last few months is the American Bar Association has also kind of has weighed in on this issue. And you can see there by their opinion on ethics. And we all know that the Bar Association does not govern the practice of law in the state of Minnesota like it does in a number of other states. But it is, again, one of those influential bodies that's come forward to talk about the reasonableness of caseloads and what defenders and supervisors and defenders' offices need to do in order to mitigate some of that. We were very concerned about that, and obviously, again, somebody with that kind of, with the Bar Association's national recognition or national presence, to be saying that is, again, one of those issues where we have to start standing up to pay attention to. The second piece of the public defender viability request, Mr. Chairman, is the salary equity proposal. Over the last several years, the legislature has committed itself to salary parity between attorney generals and public defenders. We have fallen behind, as you can see by that chart. The top of our salary range tops out at about $92,000. The last information we had for last year was the Attorney General's office topped out at $110,000. The proposal before you would provide a salary equity with the county attorneys in 10 of the counties where most of our public defender cases occur. And we do this for a couple of reasons. One is the $110,000 would provide for salary compression, because we do have managing attorneys that are in between our line lawyers and our chief public defenders, and our chief public defenders and state public defender are capped by what the salary of a trial court judge is. And so, number one, we'd have salary compression. Number two is, as most of you I'm sure are aware, the attorneys in the Attorney General's office are at-will employees, and they are based on merit pay. We have a union situation. The Teamsters represent our attorneys, and a separate Teamsters unit represents our support staff. So it isn't comparing apples to apples like it was, let's say, in 1998 when the legislature first made their commitment to that Attorney General scale. So what we're looking around for is what is a comparable job, what's a comparable caseload, those kinds of things. And so we're asking for salary equity with the county attorneys in those counties, again, where most of the public defender cases occur. Chairman, the next part of that is, is existing drug courts. You heard the court's presentation last week. There are 21 existing drug courts. They are extremely labor-intensive. We have had situations where local and federal funding are provided for those, at least for the court of the prosecution function, and with no additional resources for public defenders. So we've had 21 of these since 1997. At the same time, we've had, at last count, 18 new judgeships added since 1997 without an increase in public defender funding or increase in numbers of public defenders. This has become a very burdensome issue. Again, we're fully supportive of the drug courts. They work very well. But cases that may have been closed at one or two hearings now extend well beyond that. And I think you've all heard, the labor-intensive nature of these when the court made its presentation last week. Again, they're very good. We fully support them. But it's now become an issue of how are we going to manage this? And I'd like to give you a couple of examples. There has been, for years, been no drug court on the range. The range finally got a drug court, got some federal money to do it. So the call came to the chief public defender, well, we need a lawyer up here. Well, so now we have to have a lawyer that goes from Duluth to Hibbing or Duluth to Virginia to do drug court. Again, no additional funding for that position or to go ahead and do that. Down in Brown County, New Ulm. The judges down there wanted to start three different drug courts at one time, a regular drug court, a CHIPS drug court, and a juvenile drug court. We have one three-quarter time defender in New Ulm. So the question is what are we going to do with that person's time in terms of operating those drug courts? Those are still in discussion, and I don't know exactly where they are right now, but those are the natures of the demands on those folks, particularly in those rural areas. Chairman, the next request is, the next part of that request is for data entry. Right now, our part-time defenders do all of their own data entry. If they don't do it, they are paying their secretaries to do that. We do not provide that service for them, so they're paying that out of pocket. It's a problem for a couple of reasons. One is, obviously, it's not very efficient if we have lawyers who are doing data entry. Two is, it's for us, it's a question of fairness to have our part-time defenders paying out of their pocket for essentially a state function, which is the data entry of case closing and case opening forms and case hour forms. Obviously, it's information we have to have. It's obviously information that you need to have. But it's a question of fairness. The other issue tends to be, and this is starting to ease somewhat, is a number of them still don't have high-speed internet access. And so it's very, very time-consuming for them to be doing this and to have somebody in their own office doing it without us, without the state paying for that function. This is a big deal, a big issue with our part-time defenders. In fact, outside of the salary and benefit issue, this is probably their number one issue. Chairman, the last piece of the viability request is for our public defense corporations. They provide service to the minority communities. They provide service to about 5,000 cases a year that otherwise would be public defender cases. We're asking for a 3.5% increase on their grant agreement and also a 10% increase on the total that we provide or that you all provide to those corporations to try to even out the funding based on the caseloads that they represent. And to give you a very brief history is the corporations actually started back in the mid-1970s. And as corporations were added, as the legislature went through the process, at that time there were individual riders or individual appropriations for corporations that didn't necessarily have to do with how many cases they were handling or, you know, what the actual was going on. Over the years, that kind of evolved into a grant program that was in the Department of Administration, and I don't believe it was in the courts, but it was in various places, and then when the board was created, ended up in the board's budget. And again, it had nothing to do necessarily with how many cases they were handling or the workload. When the state began assuming the costs from the counties of public defense services, there were county grants that were also going to some of these corporations. And so, again, not based on any caseload information or based on caseloads. So we're asking for additional money to try to even those out among those five corporations. Mr. Chairman, the next request is for appellate caseloads. We're asking for four new lawyers and a legal secretary to provide, again, for the caseload increase over the last 2 years in appellate cases. If you look at the chart on page 20, you can see the tremendous increase that office has absorbed over the last 2 years. If you saw the chart from 2 years ago, it was almost identical to this. They continue to labor under extremely heavy caseloads and are having difficulty meeting the appellate court timelines. Again, it's an issue of kind of an ecosystem. We're not able to, if you're pouring money, you've got more species of one sort in the mix, it doesn't really work. And they're having a difficult time right now in the appellate office trying to meet their obligations in terms of the deadlines for appellate briefs to be filed. I know they've had a number of issues relative to the trial level, to the post-conviction proceedings. And as you can see, the end of confinement review hearings are the fastest growing area, one of the fastest growing areas that these folks are seeing, which again should come as no surprise given the emphasis on sex offenders and sex offender release and all of those issues. Again, not to debate that issue, but just to say, we're here to tell you that this is what's going on in terms of the increase in caseloads. If you look at showed you this chart last month, again, if you look at the appellate cases and the supervised release files or the parole revocation hearings versus the adult inmate population, you can see that those numbers track almost identically. And again, it's no surprise that for those of you who have been around here for a while, see the numbers of people that we continue to put away in prison and see the increase in the number of appellate files or the supervised release files. The other issue is, as Chairman, you know, and then know a number of you have dealt with, is the cost of appellate transcripts in that office. And that chart on page 22 shows you the increase over the last several years of where the transcript costs have gone. And again, no surprise given the number of cases that we're dealing with and the increase in the complexity of those cases. Mr. Chairman, the last piece, or the last request is by far the largest. It makes up about half of this request, total request for the board. We understand that is the large request, but it deals with the child protection cases and the court's 2006 CHIPS Public Defender Task Force report. I think all of you have that report in your packet. This work group was a result of some discussions that the legislature had 2 years ago. In the conference committee report, it came back that the legislature wanted a study on the use of public defender resources and some alternatives to CHIPS proceedings. The task force came back and recommends that the legislature immediately increase public defender funding. This task force consisted of a number of folks involved in these cases. There were judges on it. There were officials from the county government on it, public defenders, obviously, prosecutors. And the unanimous recommendation was that the legislature look at increasing funding for public defenders in this area. It would basically do three things. Meet the CJI, or the Children's Justice Initiative Protocol. That would be for children over 10 and custodial parents. It would provide for representation to non-custodial parents in child protection cases, something we generally do not do now. So that would be an expansion of the current mandate of the public defenders. And also appeals in termination of parental rights cases. Again, this one in particular, all of them a county function, and would then be moved to our state appellate office. In the event that the legislature doesn't have the funding or is unwilling to provide it, then the work group acknowledges that public defender participation in child protection cases will be required to be restricted. And in that report that you have in your packets, there is a recommendation in there in terms of how that might be accomplished. Again, Mr. Chairman, the issues on the child protection cases. Representation of parents is a county function. The board has been doing it for a number of years. When the state first assumed the cost of representation in these cases, or I should say assumed the cost of representation for public defender services, there wasn't much discussion about child protection cases. There were about 3,000 or 3,500 of them a year. There was no Children's Justice Initiative. There were no federal timelines on these cases. And so it was one of those situations, I think, where, as they tend to be around here, is things get put together at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, and general principles are agreed to, and some of the details tend to fall through the cracks. We ended up taking on that function, even though it was a county function. In the meantime, caseloads have nearly tripled. We have just over 9,000 of those cases, as you saw before. The CJI, or the Children's Justice Initiative Protocol, has been established, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Federal timelines have been imposed, 90 days from the time that CHIPS petition is filed in court until the time when the out-of-home placement has to take place. There is an ability to extend that timeline, but again, it's one that's not done routinely. There are times when public defenders are appointed to represent non-custodial parents and others. I think I told you the last time I was here, we have a number of cases all where we have the court calling up saying we need 3 or 4 or 5, or in one case in Duluth, 8 lawyers for a public defender case or for a child protection case. So the multiple clients per case, especially in the rural areas, becomes very, very difficult for us to deal with, because we normally have to draw folks in from other counties, other courtrooms, which are then left vacant. As I said, the CHIPS proposal or the task force proposal actually comes in three separate proposals. The first one is to meet the protocol for the Children's Justice Initiative. You can see here what the recommended time is for these various stages of the child protection proceeding. Based on this, we came up with the request of the needed staff to deal with those child protection cases. When we did that, we also did it based on our weighted caseload study. So we did two different methods, one by time based on the court's own Children's Justice Initiative protocol, and also by our caseload standard. And we came within two full-time equivalent lawyers of the same result using two separate methods of studying what it is we needed for those. The second piece of it is the representation of non-custodial parents. Again, the CJI would have us represent or would like us to represent those non-custodial parents in child protection cases. That would require 58 new lawyers around the state along with the associated support staff to do those cases. Again, a new function, an expansion of representation. The board's not opposed to that, but again, it's an issue of where are those resources going to come from. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the appeals and TPR cases. As you might imagine, this is one of the more serious things you can do is take away somebody's kids. Currently accounting function, it is very haphazard the way it happens. There are very tight timelines from the time that the trial level or the trial court is done with that case to the time that those cases can be appealed. It is kind of the best kept secret of the child protection system or frankly of the judicial system that there is this right to appeal. So we're asking for four lawyers in the appellate office and one legal secretary and the transcript funding to provide the service in appeals and TPR cases. Mr. Chairman, I know that was very quick. We understand it's a large budget request. We understand that it's a lot of money. It was meant to give folks some choices. It was meant to highlight some of the issues facing the board. Obviously, as you see, the largest piece of the request is for the child protection area, which, as again, some of you have been around a little bit, this issue has been around for about 6 or 8 years. There was a compromise that we thought was pretty good that was put into place last year, or was at least on both floors. Everybody involved in this said, no, come back and request the money next year. So we dropped that. We came back and asked for the money. This is the third biennium in a row that somebody has asked for money for these cases. And frankly, it's getting to the point where now something needs to be done, and I think the task force recognized that. Chief Justice Blatts in 2000 went to the governor and asked for the money. Or I guess 2002 it was. In 2004 we put it in the budget request, and we put it again in 2006. And so it's an issue, I think, whose time has come. And again, you have the task force report in your packet to go through. So with that, Mr. Chairman, again, it was very quick, but I would stand for any questions that you or the committee members might have.
Thank you, Mr. Kaya. Representative Viskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have questions on two slides. We don't need to go back to them, and it might be just more requests for further information to help my understanding. So much of the testimony dealt with case units and workload, caseload. And back on one slide, you talked about a case unit per FTE attorney formula. I believe you mentioned that felonies were worth more than misdemeanors. And I guess what I want to know, Mr. Chairman, is what is that formula? Is one felony worth 3-5 times more than a misdemeanor? Do you lose points if they plea bargain? And so if you could get me that information as to what that formula is, I'd certainly appreciate it. And then I'd also like to know if that formula is self-determined or if it's statutorily determined, Mr. Chairman. I think that's important as we're looking to fund a formula. Who sets that formula? So that's one request for information. The second is on another slide that was put forward, and that had to do with salary equity. and it was comparing the public defender salary to the average county attorney's salary and the attorney general's salary. Now, as I think about the county attorney and the attorney general, I would both say that their salaries are based on performance pay. Now, every 4 years, both county attorneys and the attorney general stand for the ultimate in performance pay decisions. They have to go in front of 30, 50, 100,000, or in some cases, millions of people, all right, to ask, how am I performing, all right, and are you going to send me back? I'm wondering if there's comparable accountability for public defenders, so that's the one thing I want to know. And you also mentioned that public defenders were part of the Teamsters, and that that hadn't always been that way, that they are unionized. So if you could provide for me the background on what led to the unionization of public defenders so I can understand and how their association with the Teamsters worked, and both of those pieces of information would help me, Mr. Chair, as we look to make, you know, decisions on, the testifier said, a pretty big budget request. Thank you.
Mr.
Chairman, I can respond very quickly to the first two of those.
Maybe you could, just provide the information to the committee that for the...
Sure.
We don't have a lot of time here, Mr. Kyer.
All right.
Representative Mueller, do you have a quick question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had several, but because of the time's run way over, I'll just ask for one thing and not now. But I'd like to know how you divvy up the money between the different... public defender offices and things like that.
Chairman, I'm happy to come and visit with Representative Mallory on that issue.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be good for everybody to know.
Do you want a written response, or do you want to respond now?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to later have a written response.
Okay.
I don't want to take up time.
Okay. Otherwise, Mr. Chairman, it's a very quick answer. There's a statute that governs how we divvy up that money. The board looks at the weighted caseloads in each district and tries to even out the caseloads across the state based on the money that's available for and the full-time equivalents that are available. That's kind of the short answer.
Okay, Mr. Kyer. Representative Ola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question on your salary chart. Would be your intent to use that $106,000 or whatever average you're coming up with that you said were from 10 counties to cover the entire state? Because I know there's no county attorneys in my area that are anywhere close to that $106,000 you're talking about.
Mr. Chairman and members, it would cover the entire state. Again, we use the county attorney scale or that county attorney scale because of the issues relative to using the attorney general scale. And again, the commitment in the legislature has been previously to the attorney general scale, and it is a statewide organization, just like troopers, just like judges, just like any other statewide organization.
Members, any other questions at this point? Thank you, Mr. Kaya, for your presentation.
Thank you.
For, if I understand it correctly, it's $41 million above the governor's recommendation. Here.
Chairman, that's what Mr. Carter says. I trusted his numbers all the time. So,
yes, this is on top of $36 million on top of the governor's recommendation for the courts. So just something to think about as we plot along here. Thank you, Mr. Carter. I appreciate your presentation and your brevity. I just want, before Representative Lesh, I'm going to take Representative Lesh's bill out of order because... Commissioner Reinhart is supposed to be at her county board meeting right now. If you could take about 10 minutes to present your bill and allow us some time to question you, Representative Lesh. As your presenters are coming up, I wanted to announce also that because of the interest in this committee on reentry and sentencing, that we will be creating a subcommittee on reentry and sentencing. That will be looking at an article for the omnibus bill on reentry and also further efforts on reentry in the interim. And Representative Eastland has agreed to co-chair that committee with me, and we'll be examining some of the reentry bills before they come to this bill after. They've moved through Representative Mullery's committee. So, with that, Representative Lesh, you want to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll go as briefly as possible. In fact, I'll allow the two testifiers who are here with me to explain the bill itself. It is just two sentences. But as folks are familiar with your handout, ACE is an early intervention program for child offenders at high risk of serious, violent, and chronic crimes. I have with me Ed Frickson, the project director for ACE, and Ramsey County Commissioner Victoria Reinhart. So, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you and committee members, I'll have Commissioner Reinhart begin by explaining the program.
Mr. Reinhart, welcome to the committee. Please present your testimony.
Thank you. I am Ramsey County Commissioner Victoria Reinhart, and ACE has, we call it ACE, All Children Excel. When ACE started in 1999, it was called the Outcome-Based Program Area Budgeting for Secondary Juvenile Crime Prevention, and so you can see why we changed the name. It is really, it is an early intervention program for children that are at the highest risk of becoming chronic, serious, and violent offenders when they become adults. It's for children 6 through 9 years old. As 10 years old is the first age at which a child can be prosecuted in the state of Minnesota. So we're trying to change the trajectory of these children's lives very early on. We know from Dr. Howard Snyder's research that these kids, the highest risk kids, are 8% of the population, of the adolescent population, and will commit up to 70% of all serious and violent crime committed by adolescents in the United States. So these kids are very, very difficult to try to deal with and often fall through the cracks because the traditional programs that are out there for the less serious potential offenders really can't address all of the multiple needs. Each of these kids has multiple risk factors. We have developed a risk assessment tool for ACE that is one of a kind in the nation because of it being for such young age children. And we have had an intensive evaluation of not only the assessment tool, but also of the outcomes. And I believe that you have a handout that shows the evaluation results for ACE. And the fact of the matter is we're getting very positive results. Of the one of the things that I think is most striking is when you look at the highest risk kids, without the ACE intervention, 82.7 of the highest risk children will commit a chargeable offense. With ACE, it's 30.5%. And when you look at the cost of treating or dealing with children that are in serious trouble in our system, the cost is very, very high per individual. I do want to, because I know that we're kind of struggling for time here, I want to talk about the ACE costs, or the reduced cost to society, and that's on the bottom half of the page. What's listed here is it talks about the cost to treat one individual, and in fact, it's more than one individual. When a child is accepted into ACE, the entire family receives the treatment. And so the cost that's listed here is to treat the ACE child. In Ramsey County, the average ACE family has 4.3 members. You can actually divide that or multiply the savings, however you would like to do that, to really look at what the cost savings or the potential cost savings is to government, and not just at the county level, but at the state level, the federal level, and even the municipal level and public defender's office and the courts. All of that combined obviously has a huge price tag attached to it. Dr. Mark Cohen has indicated that when you look at a child, a chronic juvenile offender, and try to calculate the cost to society from beginning at age 10, the cost to society is $3.4 million per child. We have had tremendous results with ACE. We have it has become a national model of how to do things correctly, but as you all know, the costs associated with prevention activities, the costs or the taxpayers and the funding that's coming from the state and the federal government have really been cut over the last few years, so prevention efforts are very difficult to fund. The request is for $620,000, as I said, or as you can look at this, if you look at per ACE child, it is $22 per day compared to when you look at mentally ill and gang-related sex offenders, $485, $281 a day, down to $88 a day for adult corrections and $100 per day for juvenile corrections. And one final note that I would like to point out is you notice that we do have the sex offender costs that are listed here. And the reality is, and remember, again, we're talking 6 through 9-year-olds that are in ACE. 10% of those children in ACE, the highest risk kids, are there because of sex offenses.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, next, if it's okay with you, Ed Frickson, who's the project director.
Please, Mr. Frickson, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name for the record is Ed Frickson. I'm the project director for All Children Excel in Ramsey County. I'm also the supervisor for the mental health screening and assessment services across child protection and juvenile justice for Ramsey County. I was the mental health consultant with ACE for several years and became the director of the project in spring of 2006. I just wanted to follow up on a couple of the comments, Mr. Chairman, that Commissioner Reinhart made. These children are all identified prior to the age of 10 in Ramsey County, and they're all referred into our county attorney's office based on a police report. We work very, very closely with all law enforcement, St. Paul Police Department, the suburban police departments, and the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department. They refer all of these children prior to the age of 10 into us, where we take an in-depth look. It takes about 4 to 6 hours, depending on how much information is out there on the child, their siblings, and the family's history, to really get a good sense of what level of risk factors do these children have and how can we best identify the most at-risk children for severe violent chronic offending across a career of crime. And what we're finding in our ongoing evaluation in these highest-risk children in the very high-risk families we're working with, I don't know if you have in your handout a copy of this particular slide or not. If not, okay, I have that here and I can make that available too. It's also on our website, which is found in the lower left-hand corner of the one-page handout you do have. But it identifies clearly some of the risk factors these children come with. We know that in our with our ACE children, that 83% of these 83% of these children have a father with significant criminal history, and that 74% of the mothers come with criminal histories as well, and that over 80% of these families come with significant prior child protection histories. Our evaluation is finding that it's taking about 3.5 years to maintain to build and maintain a positive working relationship with these families. This is not a short-term intervention. These are incredibly difficult families to engage. They've been involved in child protection. The parents have significant criminal histories, child protection histories. There's significant mental illness, chemical health histories in these families. 50% of our children in the program come with prior mental health histories already, which is significant because these families tend to avoid services. The ACE intervention, we identify kids at the average age of 8.5. Our youngest child we have identified is age 4. And we work with them until they turn age 18 because we know it takes a significant amount of time simply to engage and build a relationship before we can start building healthy development within these families and start to turn the corner. And that's where you start to see the difference between 82.7% of the kids who don't get the ACE intervention who will reoffend by the age of 13. Again, average age of intake is 8.5, compared to a little over 30% of the kids involved in ACE will still reoffend by their 13th birthday. So they continue to be high-risk children. But we're starting to see a significant difference in how they and how they're turning the corner. One of our kids recently, as of Friday, has been offered an internship with the City of St. Paul in the city attorney's office. He's went from a full-time level 5 special education where he was assaulted to peers and to staff, female and male staff. He's been out of the home several times in different placements. And he was identified at age 8. And at age 14.5 is when, for whatever reason, the light bulb started to come on and he started to articulate, I want my life to be different. And at that point is when he really started to exhibit and internalize that change for himself. He was the victim of sexual abuse. He sexually abused several other children in the neighborhood. as well. He was a very, very high-risk kid. He was running the streets day and night at age 10. Father's rights were terminated. His parental rights were terminated. Mother has been in and out of prison herself, but we followed that kid throughout. One other thing, very briefly, we've developed a manual series so that this program can also be replicated in part or in full, the comprehensive program, in any other county in Minnesota or elsewhere as well. So this is not a standalone model. It can be replicated in other places as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Frickson. Two questions. Representative Murphy's first, and then Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much money are you receiving from the state for this program at this time?
We are currently not receiving
state. Mr. Frickson.
Currently, at this point, we're receiving some county tax levy dollars for the Ramsey County model, and the program has primarily been funded through a combination of grants and some federal child welfare targeted case management revenue based on the contacts our case managers have with children.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergson?
Yes.
The grants, the program, are any of them from the state of Minnesota, Department of Public Safety?
There is Department of Public Safety grant that is expiring. There have been several other small state grants over time.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergson, could you give us the amount of money from each of those small state grants and the amount of money from the program that is expiring, but I believe that you can reapply?
Mr. Frickson.
Mr. Chair, we can reapply for grants. We are finding that because the program has been up and running since 1999, that most granting agencies are more interested in funding startup programs rather than ongoing services. So we're finding that we've made the local policy decision to not reapply for grants because we've been denied in grant opportunities now for 2 to 3 years. For those grant opportunities out there. And in answer to your first question, I don't have that information with me, but I can definitely get that in writing to the chairman.
Thank you. That's it. Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, this person, does $66,000 per year sound about right?
Mr. Felton?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Reinhart, I've been trying to figure out at $22 a day and $620,000 appropriation requested, how many children are you planning on serving?
Mr. Frickson.
With that $620,000?
Mr. Frickson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that program, in addition to the county tax levy dollars we currently receive from Ramsey County, would serve 70 targeted children and their families. Again, these are young children embedded in families, so you can multiply that with 70 children by about 4.3, 4.5 other members per family. So about 300 individuals would be impacted.
And then, Mr. Bergson, you're planning on the number of children per month to increase from 5 up to 7?
70. Mr. Frickson, what number did you say?
You said you were going to serve 70,000 children, and on this thing it says that you get 5 a month that you're screening and so forth. And so I'm trying to work the numbers.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I can clarify that for you slightly. We are screening for about 5 children per month are referred, approved for screening based on a law enforcement report through our county attorney office, who approves it to make sure that it would be legally sufficient and chargeable if the child were 10. So then of that, we're identifying about 2 children per month who are at extremely high risk for severe violent chronic offending in Ramsey County. So we're averaging about 24 children per year in Ramsey County identified at the very highest risk for severe violent chronic offending. A very small proportion of children. Ramsey County has about 10% of the state census for children under 10. So you could extrapolate that to about 225 children per in the state annually who could be identified as at high risk for severe violent chronic juvenile offending.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This program goes way back to the information that Janet Wigg did in her study when she was working with Hennepin County and the children under 10 thing, and so that's been alive for at least 20 years, and I offered the bill to sponsor the legislation to do the research for the children under 10, and so it's good to see that our conclusions were well-founded and to center on the at-risk children certainly is a prevention tactic that we have, but I still, the $620,000 from the state is a very large sum of money for a program that seems to have been doing fine in the county. But I can understand why you want to share some of the responsibility with the state based on what you said, that you're keeping them out of prison down the road. And I understand that. I accept that. But if you could give us a breakdown in writing of where your current funding is coming from, and especially the amounts from the state over the years, that would be very much appreciated. So we can look at that and weigh what the state's responsibility is then.
You'll provide that to the committee. Representative Smith is next.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Frickson, good morning. Welcome to the committee. Maybe three questions. When you were describing your employment, I believe you said that you, as well as being project director for ACE, you were also, in addition to that, a supervisor with Ramsey County, and I didn't hear the balance of your answer.
Mr. Frickson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Smith, I am the supervisor responsible for mental health screening and follow-up assessment services for children involved in child welfare, child protection, and juvenile justice for Ramsey.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith.
Mr. Frickson, then those are two separate areas of employment.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Frickson. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Frickson, so do you receive a salary from both the ACE project and also your duties as a supervisor?
Mr. Frickson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm salaried. I'm paid by Ramsey County. Half of my salary covers the responsibilities with the All Children Excel program, and the remaining half is for my work with the Mental Health Screening Initiative.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Frickson, what is your gross salary per year? Also describe what health and dental insurance benefits you have, what vacation schedule you have as well, and how many employees you supervise in both of these roles. So on your salary, if you'd start with that.
Mr. Frickson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my annual gross salary is, I haven't looked recently, I believe it's $76,000 annually. And then benefits are in addition to that. My vacation accrual is about 6.1 hours per two-week pay period. I have a family health insurance plan that covers my wife and my children and myself, and a dental plan as well. I supervise across the two programs that I manage a total of 26 clinicians and two clerks support staff as well in those two programs.
Thank you.
Okay, final question, Representative Lilly, and then we'll move on to the next bill, if we could.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative, good morning, Representative Reinhart and Mr. Frickson. The other day I had the opportunity to visit with Mr. Frickson about this program. I have to admit that I really wasn't familiar with it, and I kind of, after thinking about it that day and today again this morning, it's kind of like the opposite of, early childhood education that we are talking about up here, and, you know, that's getting kids off to a good start, and, you know, getting them on their way into the education system and doing well. And this is kind of the opposite. This is stopping their start and changing it and getting them going, hopefully back in the right way and saving us quite a bit of money, I hope, in the long run. But in the visit I had with you, I thought one of the things that was fascinating, we're talking about one county here. And, you know, I'd love to see this thing going statewide myself, and maybe Mr. Friction, how do you say it? Sorry.
Friction.
Sorry, sir. Anyways, you can mention, I thought one of the things that was interesting, another state in our country, I guess, is talking about doing this statewide. And I wish we would, you know, I hope that we at some point look beyond Ramsey County and look at doing what some other state has the courage and wisdom to take and go statewide with. I don't know if you can say anything about that. And I thought that was pretty exciting.
Ms. Mano, why don't I give you the last word, because you had your hand up earlier that you wanted to respond to.
The state that Representative Lilly is referring to is New Mexico, and there are two state legislators there that have gathered, we have provided all of the information for replicating ACE statewide in New Mexico, and they're very serious about doing that. I also wanted, the reason I had my hand up earlier is I'd like to give credit where credit is due, and that is ACE is modeled after the Delinquents Under 10 program in Hennepin County. Worked very closely with Janet Wieg and other staff from Hennepin County, and they told us what we needed to add to make it a more sustainable program, and that's evaluation and working closely with the school districts, the police, and the county attorney's office. And so we built upon that program, and I do want to give credit where credit is due.
Representative Smith, you had a final
question. Mr. Chairman, I did. Thank you for an additional question. Tell us, what is your total budget of ACE per year? And in answering that question, these other sources of income, grants from federal or state, what is that number currently now? What's your total budget? And how will this $620,000 be used? Will it be used to alleviate some of that, or will it be added and added extra? So your budget, what you're currently getting elsewhere.
Mr. Fritzen, can you do that briefly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, our current budget for the program annually is $740,000, $120,000 of which is county tax levy dollars that go into the program. And we are working under the assumption that granting agencies will likely not refund the program. So we are looking at a deficit at the end of this calendar year of $620,000.
Thank you.
Anything else? President Lesh, you have a closing remark? Or
so, Mr. Chair, members, I think it's been said most adequately by Mr. Friction and Commissioner Reinhart. It is complicated based on the data that was mentioned by Representative Murphy and some of the individuals, but I think the data shows that it's been very successful in this result. So we'd appreciate your support. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lesh, Mr. Friction, Commissioner Reinhart, for coming this morning. The chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before starting, we now have a quorum. Would somebody like to move to approve the minutes of February 8th and February 13th?
So moved.
Motion by Dominic. Is there any corrections? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Carried. Representative Paymar, I understand you have an amendment to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to, in order to get the bill in the order I would like, I have an oral amendment, page 1, line 8. It should read the Commissioner of Corrections instead of Public Safety, and I would move that.
Motion by Representative Paymar to change to Commissioner of Corrections on line 8 instead of Public Safety. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. You may proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 342 provides a grant of $250,000 each year for mentoring of children of incarcerated parents. One, surprisingly and amazingly, one in 40 children has a parent in prison. These children suffer from profound negative effects on their development, including feelings of guilt, shame, and rejection, and a lack of trust, as you can imagine. We have, if we do nothing, the possibilities that we'll see another generation whose future moves them closer to the juvenile and criminal justice system seems more of a reality. There are some, again, an amazing statistic. There are approximately 7,500 young people in Minnesota that have at least one parent who is incarcerated. And this is a grant to the Commissioner of Public Safety that spells out grant criteria to provide the kind of mentoring for these children that they so desperately need. And I think someone who can better explain how this program has worked in the past as the CEO of Big Brothers and Big Sisters. I just want to make note that this was a governor's initiative in the last biennium. It's not in his budget this year, and so we are asking for $500,000 over the biennium to fund this, to fund a mentoring program. And so with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Lewis.
Ms. Lewis, would you please state your name and proceed?
I am Gloria Lewis. I am the president and CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Greater Twin Cities, and thank you for allowing us to be here today. Just let me give you a little bit of an overview of what we have done working with children throughout the area who have parents who are incarcerated. One of the things that we know, we started about 3 years ago. Initially, this started from a federal grant. We were absolutely amazed at the number of children that surfaced in terms of coming to our agency and needing a big brother or a big sister because they have a parent, and some have as many as two, both parents, are incarcerated. We were able to work with several organizations, one being the Search Institute and the other being the Council on Crime and Justice. We wanted to make sure that we knew exactly what we were doing. We wanted to make sure that we knew exactly what we were getting into. We know that we know how to mentor. That is something that Big Brothers Big Sisters has done for 104 years. We know the training that's required. We know what's required. But we also needed to have the support of agencies that work with the criminal justice system, that go into the prisons, that work with the families who request services for their children. Out of that number, the major thing that we have to look at when anyone is working with the child is the length or retention. It is worse to have a situation where a child is mentored for 6 months or less. That is more dangerous than not having a mentor at all. Our goal is to, of course, make sure that there is longevity within the mentoring. Therefore, we've been able to maintain over 219 children who have mentors, and in this first year of having the state money that we're going into, we've added another 39 children and moving into another 68 that we're waiting to also to match up. Our children keep coming. Our families are out there. You've heard previously from the previous testimony about the children who are really highly at risk and need intervention at such a young age. Our goal is to be a prevention program, that children come in, that they will not repeat the same pattern that they've seen before. So we are asking for this, for these dollars to continue to do this work, to work with our children who need it, because we're talking about the children who are in the state of Minnesota. And if there are 7,500 children out there now, and 1 in 40 children have a chance of becoming incarcerated, that means that as opposed to our criminal justice system and as opposed to our prison system getting smaller, it's just going to get larger, or we will continue with the pattern that we keep putting people back into the prison system. And we don't want to start with young people doing that. We work with young people starting at age 7 through 13. They can stay with us until they graduate from high school. And we're very, very, very concerned about their education. Our goal is to make sure that you, one, graduate high school, and two, go on to some form of post-secondary education. And we have some of the children in this program that we see are moving in the right direction. Not only will they finish high school, but they'll be the young people to go to college as well, because they've had the opportunity to have a mentor.
Maybe we'll finish the witnesses before taking questions. So.
Mr. Griffin, do you want to make some comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm a lobbyist and work in conjunction with Gloria Lewis and the folks at Big Brothers and Big Sisters with my partner, Linda Sandvig, who is in the back. We're happy to be here today, and we don't want to take up the committee's time because we actually have some people that are involved in the program, both as mentors, bigs and littles, as we call them, and we'd like to bring them up to the stand to just give you a brief view of their views of the program.
Please do so. Okay, which everyone wants to start, you can go ahead. Please state your name.
My name is Lane Dorsey, Mr. Chair, and I'm from St. Paul. I'm the grandmother of a little. Caitlin lives with me because her parents have both had bouts of incarceration. The Big Sister, Big Brother, Big Sister program really has made a difference in Caitlin's life. She's had a big sister through school since second grade. She's in sixth grade now, and she just got a community-based big sister. With the community-based big sister, she's been able to take her in her car, take her to her college dorm or the house that she lives in with other girls, and has put a real face on college for Caitlin. It's let her know a generation that Caitlin's pretty much missed out in her life. She's got old people like me in her life, and then she has her peers, but she really didn't see that generation. And the kids that she did see of that age from our neighborhood weren't really the college-bound students or children that I would want her to be associated with. With Kathleen, she's been, like I say, been able to go to her house. They cook things. They go to movies. They go to gymnastics meets. It's been a wonderful experience for Caitlin. We talked about college in length before the big sister, but as soon as she got back from St. Thomas, is it St. Thomas?
St.
Thomas. St. Thomas, Grandma, I want to go to college. It looks like so much fun, and you only have to go to school for 2 hours. So I think it really it put a real drive in her, and it made her see a whole way of life that I don't think she knew was open to her until she had this big sister. It's really, really made a difference, and I hope a lot of kids like Caitlin in her situation can experience the same kind of relationships. It's been very, very positive for Caitlin. Thank you.
Caitlin, do you want to make some comments? Could you state your name first?
My name is Caitlin Rosie. And I think it's really fun having a big sister because they can show you other things. And she takes me to her house and we cook things and she showed me her college. And we have fun. And I can talk to her about things and she brings me places.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know Caitlin's a little bit nervous about being here this morning, but we told her you'd...
Would you state your name, please, sir?
Phil Griffin again, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. With Big Brothers, Big Sisters. But I think what she's talking about is the kind of influence we see that a lot of the mentors have. And I'd like to introduce Pete to talk about his experiences as a mentor and the work that he's doing as a volunteer with Big Brothers Big Sisters.
Mr. Chairman, and
would you state your name, sir?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Pete Rhodes, Chair and distinguished members this morning. It is indeed a pleasure to be here to talk on behalf of Big Brothers and Big Sisters. I, about 2 years ago, took on the task of taking a young one underneath my wings to become a mentor, to give back to my community. And we here today realize that our future is our citizens are like Caitlin. They are our future. And they are in need of hope and direction and discipline. And mentors create that. I truly believe that. They provide positive images. I'm sure that I provide a very positive image to Luigi. Today, in fact, I give up an entire day to get here this morning to talk on behalf of Big Brothers and Big Sisters and its importance. Put aside my important meeting with a client to meet with Luigi even later today and give him that little piece of positiveness that he needs. We also give Luigi direction and surely some discipline. Today we've heard from professionals working in the criminal justice system and in child intervention, and we've heard there is a backlog in our criminal justice system. We also look at the fact that there are potential criminals in our youth and that without intervention, they will truly offend on all levels. So I think it's important. I'm a big brother, and I'm glad to be a big brother. I'm glad to be here today because I know that not only will I get a chance to talk with you and hopefully encourage you to do the same as I'm doing, and that is to touch youth in our community. And I encourage you to support the efforts of Big Brothers and Big Sisters as they move forward to be a part of more lives in our community to help our future citizens be productive citizens in our community. And thank you for having me and allowing me to talk to you today.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, I believe you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Haymar, is this one grant?
Are there any questions for the witnesses that are presently up there? Just so we... Thank you, Caitlin, and all of you. Caitlin, you did a great job for your age.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, you asked if this is one grant. This is actually the way it's written. This would be $250,000 a year, which means that this bill has tails to it. That's what you were asking.
And it's a grant just to the Greater Twin Cities brothers and sisters?
No.
Big brothers and sisters? Or is it this?
Okay. Mr. Chair, it's a grant to the Commissioner of Corrections who would go through whatever process that they go through in evaluating programs, who have the expertise in providing mentoring as outlined subdivision 2 of the grant. I don't know of other programs that are providing this kind of service. There could be some out there. Maybe Ms. Lewis could better respond to that.
Ms. Lewis, would you?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, wanting to let you know that this is describing exactly the work that needs to be done with children of prisons throughout the state of Minnesota. If there are other organizations that meet that criteria, I'm sure that they would certainly be in this bill. It is one that we're here to tell you what we know that we do, but we're also saying that they're throughout the state. There are all those children, so they're not just in the greater Twin Cities, and that we also have the capacity to work with other groups to help them design this kind of program that actually fits and meets the needs of these children.
I see. Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kamen, clarification. That is what I was trying to get at. So one grant for $250,000 per year, $500,000 biennium, and then the $500,000 or the $250,000 could be divided up for other organizations statewide that meet the criteria. And it wouldn't just go to Big Brothers and Big Sisters of the Twin Cities, but the Big Brothers of Duluth, the Big Brothers and Sisters of Cloquet, other mentoring groups that had a bill in last year could apply for a portion of the $250,000 and be given money. So it is truly a statewide bill and not a greater metropolitan area bill.
Representative Paymar, would you like to respond?
Mr. Chairman, that is the intent, but I see a problem here that maybe we should just, if we we want to be true to the intent, unless Ms. Lewis has a problem with it, maybe we should amend. We would need to amend page one of the bill then. It does say the Greater Twin Cities area.
And change it from grant to grant? May award and take the A out on the first line?
Mm-hmm. Yes, what Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, if I could, if this works, staff on line 9, put an S after grant to grants to nonprofit organizations that provide one-to-one mentoring. So you would delete that is located in the Greater Twin Cities area, and would that read right?
Representative Coles, I think, has a comment on that, so I'll let him.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, I think that might read right. I think we've got to get rid of the A on line 8 as well. But, Mr. Chair, as Representative Mullery, I know, can attest that I'm a little bit of a stickler for procedure. And I know we've already, I think, adopted an amendment, but I don't know that the bill was ever moved, Mr. Chair.
No.
And I'd like, maybe Representative Paymar, I'm not trying to bollocks things up here, but I am a stickler for process, and could we maybe get the bill in front of us? Because I don't know that it is.
Okay.
I believe Ms. Representative Coles is correct.
Mr. Chairman, then I would move House File 342 I would move House 342 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
As amended the first time?
As amended. And now I guess I would open be up to discussion about my amendment. Can I just say that,
yes.
Representative Murphy, I mean, the reason why we have this language in there is obviously it was what's the percentage in the Twin Cities metro area. The majority of children whose parents are incarcerated are obviously in the greater metropolitan area. That was the intent of it.
Just for the record, would you restate, Representative Paymar, would you restate the amendment and move it now so we will? In the right order.
Mr. Chair, then I would move on line 9, page 1, add an S to grant, so it reads grants, 2, delete A, add an S to organizations, so it reads grants to nonprofit organizations, and delete that is located in the Greater Twin Cities area, and insert that. I think that reads correctly.
Delete A on line 8.
Mr. Diebel, is that?
Delete the A on line 8 too? Would that be correct?
Yes.
Drop the S behind provide, so it says that provide instead of provides.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. That would.
You've heard the amendment presented by Representative Paymar. Is there discussion on the amendment? Seeing no discussion on the amendment, would all those in favor of the amendment say aye?
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is accepted. We now can proceed. Representative Coles, do you have another question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lewis, quickly, I know we're running out of time. First of all, thank you very much for coming, and I'm a fan of Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and you guys do wonderful work. My question, though, is about the Big Brothers, Big Sisters budget kind of in general. I know that you've had an extreme amount of success in terms of raising funds from the corporate community here in the Twin Cities and elsewhere. Can you talk to me a little bit about how big is the Big Brothers, Big Sisters budget for your organization of the Greater Twin Cities or whatever the Surely. Official name is?
Surely. Our budget is $4.475 million. We serve 3,700 matches per year. We have a waiting list that is approximately 1,000 children who are waiting, which means that we're unable to serve those children just yet until we're able to get the mentors, which are the costs associated with that. So our budget is one that we are one of the
If you look at it per match, what it costs us to serve a child is approximately $1,200. If you look at many budgets, you don't find a budget that would really support a child being served for $1,200.
Representative Coles, you got to follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lewis, can you explain to me a little bit what, if your organization were to receive this grant, this $250,000 a year, what exactly would you use those dollars for?
Those dollars would be used for, let me say also, not only would this impact the greater Twin Cities, because most people think of Ramsey County and Hennepin, we serve 11 counties as well that outside of the greater Twin Cities. Those dollars would account for the recruitment of mentors for children. It would account for the training that is required. We are a stickler about training before you are matched with a child. It will account for background checks that have to be done on every single mentor. No one mentors in Big Brothers Big Sisters without a background check. It would account for the activities that children need. It would account for the staff that have to support these matches. No person is on their own, no mentor in this agency, in this organization, without match support staff who not only call them, have face-to-face meetings with them, provide them with additional training when they need it, and look for additional resources to assist the mentor in that. So that's how those dollars would be used.
Representative
for evaluation.
Ms. Lewis, I think this is, you can probably answer this as quickly as you did the first one. Of the $4.475 million in your budget, how much of that, either in dollars or as a percentage, comes from government sources?
Very small amount at this time. I would say that it's less than, 10%? That comes less than that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy, I'll give you the last question because you had a follow-up when I cut you off.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lewis, could you provide in writing the amount of money you get from the state?
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, Phil Griffin again. I just add to Representative Coles, we'd love to invite you to help us with that corporate giving out Saturday evening. We have our annual gala at the Metropolitan Ballroom next to your offices. I'll make sure you have a ticket available for free.
Please don't give it to me. You might get in trouble if you give it to me.
Representative Paymar, you have any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair, I would just renew my motion and ask that the bill will be laid over.
This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Bill, at this, we will adjourn the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.